All right, everybody, this is Chase March, and I have Dr. Richard Selznick on the phone right now, author of School Struggles, A Guide to Your Shutdown Learner's Success. It's quite the read. I took quite a lot of notes as I read this thing, took underlines on here, and as a teacher, I think it's important for us to try to reach those, like every student, especially students that have shut down. So you have some tips in here that are kind of interesting. One of them being that you shouldn't go by the child's age as, you know, a signpost of what he should be able to do or she. One of the quotes says, when talking to children at school, it's essential to set aside their real age and to view them instead of being much younger than in their maturity level. So what do you mean exactly by that?
My experience with that, and I want to clarify just for one second, I'm talking about kids with learning disabilities and ADHD, not all children. So, you know, the kids that are mostly the ones that land on my doorstep, if you follow me. So a number of years ago, when I got my first job in a private school for kids with learning disabilities, the then director said something like to staff, to make sure you have your, in a sense, your like age adjustment correct, so that when you're talking, you know, we tend to carry into our interactions with kids, let's say a 15-year-old, set as to the level of maturity or what they should be able to do at that point in their lives. And the director's caution to us was, we need to be very careful with that because many of them are not yet there. You know, the learning disabilities, which often, difficulty with things like independent functioning and executive skills and organization, even social maturity. I think we remember talking to a 15-year-old girl. Oh, it was almost like she was 11. And by looking at her like she was 11, not talking down to her, but by thinking of her like she was 11, it helped me kind of deal with where she was developmentally. And I find a lot of parents and teachers, frankly, they'll use a lot of that should language, you know, where, well, they're 15, they should be able to do things on their own. And I had the child in front of me, or I just evaluated the child and realized, man, they're not even close to that level of what the school or the parents think they should be able to do. And by adjusting that, I find it takes some of the heat out of the interaction between the parent and the child, say, they're not necessarily going soft on the child, but they kind of look at the child with a little bit more realistic eyes or realistic lenses, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think it's important to know your child, whether it's your child biologically or your child in your class,
right?
Speaking as a teacher, it's important to know that. But part of the problem, and you address it in the book, is called the curriculum shift. Like, we're expected as teachers to get this across and for the student to have this kind of a response. Like, I actually have something called exemplars that show you what a level B should look like for this grade. And quite frankly, not every student's B level work is going to look like that exemplar. It makes it tough because sometimes feels like I have my hands cuffed because I'm expected to report on certain things a certain way from a certain level. You know what I mean?
I'm sure you feel that way a lot. And the kids that I'm dealing with are the strugglers, you know, and the ones that are really having difficulty for a whole host of reasons. And that notion of the curriculum ship going forward, and, you know, the ship must go forward. It's leaving the dock in September, and it's going to arrive at port in June. And no matter what, we're getting there. And, well, that's great for about 50% of the population or 60% of the population. But for the 40% of the other kids, they're not able to stay with that boat, that ship, you know, that curriculum. And that, I don't have a ready answer for that, but I know they can't keep up with it.
Yeah, another great quote I got out of the book here is on page 106. It says, one of my rants was triggered by a line in a report on a learning disabled dyslexic that said, Frank must learn to accept responsibility for his reading comprehension and develop his own strategies. Frank is 7. He's a weak reader. He's not going to accept responsibility for his reading comprehension or develop his own strategies. And, you know, that really spoke to me because I know I've written a report card comment almost like that one.
Yeah, I you know, it's a very real quote. I mean, I took, you know, what happens to me at my my office or my work is I'll have like an experience or a moment like that and go, oh my God, I got to write that down. Or I gotta, and, you know, that came across my desk and I'm looking at this child in front of me who was 7 years old, who had reading problems and, you know, attention issues and, you know, just stuff. And I'm reading this teacher saying that, you know, this kid has to take responsibility for his own learning and, you know, his comprehension. I'm like, oh my God, how can he begin to do that? How can he begin to do that? You know, he has to do it. He's about 10 years away from maybe being able to do that. And I don't want to go soft on these kids. I don't want to be seen as like somebody who's, you know, purely enabling them. But how can that be, you know?
Exactly, yeah. We're talking about struggling kids here because there are some kids that understand what school's about. They play the program. There's some other kids that are, you know, fairly smart and flexible, and they can take whatever you throw at them. But then there's those other kids that are really having a hard time.
You've seen it in the book. I call them the smooth road and the rough road. You know, 60% of the population is on the smooth road, you know, and they can kind of, out of kindergarten and in first grade, they're moving down that road, and there aren't that many problems. Things are moving along. But then there's that other group, which is what we're talking about, and that's a whole other, it's a rougher road. You know, it's a much tougher road for those kids.
You know, I think we're actually doing a little bit better in education now. I've been doing a lot of reading on this, and we have like bump it up walls and strategies and learning cycles and all sorts of things now where we kind of start with the end in mind, and we're like, well, how can we move these kids up from like level 2, which is a C, to a level 3, to a B? Yeah. How can we move them up? So we think about that kind of things. A quote here on page 70 from your book called School Struggles. As a general rule, I feel that we need to look at the task being given, and if it is over the child's head, we have to back up and make it simpler, more digestible. And you talk about this a little bit, about how sometimes people will just say, oh, try harder, you know? But the quote continues, sure, trying harder, a frequent request from parents and teachers, may help some, but over time, this wears the child down and cannot be sustained. It is up to us as adults to examine what we are asking the child to do and see if the task truly falls within the child's zone of competence. So I like what you're talking about there. I mean, that's something good for us to think about. I mean, the days of one-size-fits-all education are over. Like, we can't just expect everybody in the class to be performing at the same level, reading the same text. It's not going to make us reach every child and give them success in school.
It's something like the old school concept of instructional levels. If it's not within the child's instructional level, meaning reasonably competent on a task, and it doesn't have to just be an academic task, it could be anything in life. You know, can the child independently make his or her own lunch, for example? Some kids can, some kids can't. But if it's beyond their level, it's just frustrating. And what I see a lot are these, I have like almost like a worksheet vendetta. You know, I'm almost like a worksheet animal. Like, you know, that these kids are getting these worksheets that are just above their level. They're too hard. And, well, then what? You know, if the words are beyond their true independent or instructional level, then how can they manage it? You know, it's beyond their zone.
Yeah, exactly. One thing, I'm reading this book and I'm going along and I'm thinking, yeah, he's speaking to me. This is pretty good. He's talking about me and what I'm doing in the classroom. And then I get to this sentence. If you have a spouse, get him. Yes, I know I'm making an assumption here. I guess mothers more often are expecting to read this, or maybe that's even a stab at the lack of male teachers as well.
Right.
Because I know most teachers do seem to be women, and I guess moms might be more concerned about this than dads, but I felt like I had to point that one out to you.
I know. Well, you know, it's funny because my most recent blog, which was taken from someone from School Struggles, was, you know, moms, listen up, trust your judgment. And I put it in a parenthesis later on in the blog, you know, some dads too. And it's a little bit of a swipe, you know, it's a little bit of a, you know, interestingly, today I had a dad come into my office, and he came in by himself, you know, with a child. But 5% of the time is either a mom by herself or the dad, in effect, being dragged in by the mom, you know. And then the dad, I find, I am truly generalizing, to be a little bit more, well, he'll grow out of it, he's fine, I was just like that, what's the problem, that kind of talk, you know. And well, you know what,
to a point, that happens. Just speaking personally here, I'm an older sibling, I have one younger brother, and right. I was good in school, I was the smart kid, I had my hand up, I'd answer every single question, and then the next year the teacher would get my brother and kind of expect the same thing, and he struggled through school and didn't seem to put in too much of an effort. And what's amazing now, we're both in our 30s, he is reading incredible scientific stuff like all the time. Like he's a better student now that he's not in school, because he always learning something and reading the scientific stuff and telling me all this interesting things. Like, I'm not really into science, I'm more into the humanities and literature. But it's really interesting to see how he's become a good student now.
I'm putting in a plug right now for my first book called The Shutdown Learner, and he might fit that character. That book was about children and then also adults who are basically, I call them Lego kids, you know, they're kind of more science brain, mechanical thinking brain, and they, you know, they really often are not so great early on with reading, spelling, and writing, so they might read better, like your brother, later on for more technical reading or, you know, reading for their field, but during the early years, there was a lot of struggling, and many of these kids were kind of shut down, so you might want to read that one, too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this was an interesting read. School Struggles, A Guide to Your Shutdown Learner Success. And your earlier book sounds like just as interesting a read. One other thing I like that you do in this book is you take a little bit of a shot at the parents and that have a serious case of NBD, no backbone disorder.
I'm quick. You know, you're the first person. I've had a bunch of interviews on this, and you're the first person to kind of look at how I'm taking it. You know, I try to do it in good humor, you know, and I try to take a little swipe here and a little knock there, that kind of thing. Even at the psychologist, I'm trying to not, you know, knock the professional too a little bit. So a little teasing, you know. So yeah, the NBD, no back. I recently did a blog where I talked about parenting resolutions, and I mentioned something about no Gumby parenting, you know, and for a lot of younger people, Gumby is, they've forgotten what Gumby is. You know, there's a little toy, with, you know, rubber toy with no backbone, you know. So that's where the NBD comes in. And I find a lot of modern parents, you know, you all 30-somethings, but I saw it with my group too, you know, starting to be overly nice, no backbone, no spine when it comes to kids. And it's a recipe for disaster. And you don't want to go into totally 1950s on them, you know, like Mad Men parenting or something. But, you know, there's a middle ground. And I find so many parents to be like overly nice and syrupy. I said, stop laying on the syrup. It's so, you know, they got to have a little bit of teeth in there. You know, it's not so bad to have a little bit of teeth in there with the kids, you know?
Yeah, I don't think we can give our kids everything, too. I think there are, like you mentioned this in the book, there are, you know, have times where you unplug, you know. Don't have your kids on video games, watching TV all the time. Go out there and do something and let them know they have to work for things, because there's like this, you know, instant gratification. It's almost the day and age in which we live, you know. When I was a kid, I wanted to find out something, I had to look in a card catalog and then go find a book. Now you can get your answer within seconds wherever you are from your smartphone or from your computer by Googling it something. So like it just shows you that just kind of the day and age we live, everything's immediate. And I think kids, especially the way school's built, and I know you mentioned this in the book, it's built on that delayed gratification, you know, go through school for however many years and then you'll get a job and then you can have your life can start. You have to wait. And kids they're not used to waiting.
No, you know, you're raising so many great topics. I'd love to talk more if we had more time. We talk about just one of those, you know, like just focus down on the one topic, you know, like the electronic stuff. I mean, care. I'm sitting here as I'm talking to you with my iPad in front of me, and I'm on the iPhone, and, you know, I'll go on the computer later. You know, and I see these kids, and it saddens me. You know, they come into the office, little kids, you know, 5, 6, 7. And it used to be where I would hand them some, you know, real old school toys while I'm talking to the parents. And, you know, like little figures, and they set up the figures and, you know, create little scenes. The kids look at me like, what is this junk you're giving me? You know, what is this junk? I have my Angry Birds on my iPhone. Like, why do I want to play with this junk you're giving me? And I'm like, yeah, well, it saddens me because it's, you know, there was a time when just playing with those little figures was just kind of creative, and you had a little imagination in there, and you might have thought about going outside after school. I just don't see that very much. I don't know how it is up in Canada, but I don't see it much down my way.
You know, when I was a kid, I was playing outside on my own a lot.
Right.
It's weird that, you know, it's now it's like it feels safer if you're with them. Or, you know, I maybe understand why some parents aren't out doing anything because, you know, if they're sitting in the basement on video games, at least you know they're safe.
I guess. You know, Chase, I didn't grow up in a difficult area of New York, but I grew up in New York City in a relatively, you know, nice area, you know, Staten Island and stuff. And I don't know. We played, I can remember going out the door on Saturday mornings and, I don't know, 8 hours later, we, you know, with one interruption to come in and eat a, you know, whatever sandwich was being made for us, 8 hours later, we were coming in reluctantly. You know, with no parental steerage, no parental involvement, no one telling us what to do or how to do it, you know? And I think we're really missing something from that. That's the part in the book, too, about losing our instinct for childhood that I talked about, you know?
Yeah, you talk about a couple of things we're losing, too. And one of the things that I liked was how you talked about social interchanges and how we're losing that simply because when we were kids, if we wanted to call on our friend, we had to knock on the door. A parent answered. We could call the phone. A parent would still answer. And we'd have to say, oh, hi, Mr. So-and-so, and have that nice little pleasantry exchange.
Right. Yeah.
But now, kids don't do that anymore because everyone has their phones and they just automatically text each other or talk to each other. So you call it a sense of social invisibility.
Yeah. You know, I have two kids, and one is now a young adult, 24 years old. The other was 21, as I just mentioned. So we went through effectively 8 years of high school, right? So now high school is a period of time when you're supposed to be calling your friends. And I'm sure you remember being on the phone all the time. So that 8 years of high school with my two kids, I think the phone rang here, I don't know, 3 times maybe.
Wow.
So One of the things that was lost is the fact that we never, you know, there were some kids that we didn't necessarily know. You know, if we went beyond the immediate close friends, you know, I joke, it's called, you know, bypass the middleman. Why deal with the annoying parents? You know, like Leave It to Beaver, where you have to go, hi, Mrs. Hi, Mrs. Cleaver, Zeddy Haskell. You know, you have to lay it on a little bit and learn that skill. I mean, there's something about that. And, you know, so 8 years, the kids were called directly. So we never really said hello to their friends, or, you know, on the phone, that is. You know, people can blame us. Well, why give them cell phones? Well, that's, you know, it's kind of that's how it is. I don't know what to say about it. I don't love it, but, you know, but I noticed it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, we're totally in a different age, and I think we have to kind of roll with it, you know, and...
Yeah, I think that's true, too. I think that's true, too. It's like you can't keep bemoaning it, but I do think we have to recognize, too, that there are these losses, and we have to be a little realistic about what those things mean, both academically, you know, school-wise, as well as interpersonally.
Yeah, I agree. But there's a lot of things that we can teach. And I think one of the most important things that a teacher can do is just to be a good role model, you know?
Yeah.
Like, address other teachers by name and use Mr. and be polite and show those kind of social interactions that kids should see. Because, I mean, you have a couple rants in the book. The one was about the you know, accepting responsibility that we talked about. But one of my rants right now is kids are watching Family Channel. And when I was a kid, Family Channel was pretty tame, you know? It was family. But now I watch it, and they have these teen-type sitcoms on all the time. And, my beef with these things is those characters are genuinely mean to each other, underhanded, backstabbing kind of things. And if that's the role model, if that's what they're seeing, and they think that's normal, and you shouldn't be polite, and you can just be mean to people and get away with this kind of thing.
Things that I used to get concerned about was more of the sexual innuendos. You know, I'm far from a prude, but it's, you know, I like that protection of childhood, you know, that kind of period of, I don't know, 8, 4, or 5, whatever, to 12, whereas that, you know, they're not to be watching R-rated movies because that's for older kids and older people. But I find that a lot of the family content that they're calling family has a fair number of innuendos and, you know, double entendre jokes with sexual themes. Do you find that?
I certainly do, yeah. And like you say, it's a shame because it's almost like the media is, you know, making things for adults.
Right.
And even quite a lot of the adult humor is immature to begin with. Some of those, like, adult comedies are like, you know, it's not adult to me. It's like, you know, like, it's just so immature. And, you know, like, I actually watched, because I was bored the other day, I watched some sitcoms that, you know, I just left it on and watched like 3 sitcoms in a row, and I swear I could feel myself getting stupider.
I know what you mean. I mean, I watch Family Guy, and I think it's a funny show. I mean, but it boggles my mind that 7, 8-year-olds are watching some of this going, oh my God, they're being exposed to this stuff? Like, I don't know. I mean, again, I don't want to seem to sound like I'm, you know, in the Music Man, you know, we have trouble in River City kind of thing, but, you know, it's...
But at the same time, I think there is content out there for, you know, every age, and that maybe we should monitor that a little bit more closely.
Yeah.
And I think that's a parent's responsibility, and I can speak as a parent, and I also speak as a teacher to my kids. I'm like, why do you watch that? Like, I'll get them out on some of that stuff.
Right.
I'm like... Right. I don't watch that. You know, but that I can understand people having different tastes too. So
Yeah.
It's an interesting position that we're in, you know, trying to guide the youth, I guess, and help them learn from our experiences as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of cool that you wrote this book. And I hope people are going to check it out. It's called School Struggles: A Guide to Your Shutdown Learner's Success. We've been talking to Dr. Richard Selznick, author of the book.
Well, thanks, Trace.
Yeah, so you have a couple books out there.
I have the first one called The Shutdown Learner. Like I said, that was primarily about kids, people who are struggling with reading, spelling, and writing, but are functioning well in other aspects of life, you know, like creativity and spatial thinking, and mostly they're dyslexics, frankly, but I try to stay away from calling, you know, a more clinical name. And, you know, so many of the kids I had dealt with were, by over time, over the years, I called it the air leaking out of the tire. You know, they started to become shut down over time because of the discouragement that has kicked in, you know, and that's what that first book was about.
Yeah. I also like how you talk in the books about how you don't like labeling children as disabled or learning disabled. And I agree, because I had a kid who was mildly autistic, but, you know, it was so mild, he was like pretty much a regular kid in my eyes.
Right.
He was convinced, because he had been told so many times that he was autistic, and, you know, he used it as an excuse.
All
the time, you know, and I swear, if people didn't tell him that, I think he would have been more, you know, average instead of such a behavior problem and certain things like that.
I use a lot of like metaphors and imagery for the parents and people so I get my mind around things. I call it the big tent of normal, you know, in the circus tent. Under the big tent, there's a lot of variation, you know. And it, to me, it takes a lot for me to feel like I've been working with kids for so long that to me they're almost all normal. You know, they're all kind of like regular and, all right, so this guy's a little quirky here or he's a little bit annoying there or something, you know, but it's, does that mean they're disabled or they're disordered? I mean, I don't know. Whatever happened to just the fact that they're, you know, that part of them doesn't work as well as the others and they need to work on those skills, you know, and that's why you know, parents sort of like a label on some level, so I kind of walk the line with it, and they kind of want it. Well, but is he, does he have dyslexia? I'm like, well, he's got a little of this, a little of that. And hopefully that's satisfying, but that's more of the way I think with this, you know, with the kids.
Yeah. I try to do that with people now, too. I mean, I'm getting a little bit wiser in my old age, I guess, but I try to take people as they are. And bring them as far as they can go. I mean, that's kind of my, you know, my style. Like, I mean, we don't ever want to just remain stagnant. Like, I'm learning all the time, and I try to share that and model that, and show that we can all grow and develop regardless of where we're starting.
You know, you sound like a great teacher, and I think that it's a shame that there are so few male teachers. You know, I think there's a certain energy and spirit that guys can bring to it. You sound like a great teacher. I'm sure you're a great father too. And it's, you know, I think it's just sort of seeing kids for what they are. My dad, if you saw my first, well, I mentioned my dad in school struggles. I mentioned he was an essay about my father, and he was a principal of school. And in a lot of ways, he was my role model for this stuff because he brought that energy of, you know, he always fought the underdog with kids. He called it, you know, fighting for the underdog. You know, you always had the spirit of, you know, there were certain kids who were not on the level playing field, and he didn't have 504 plans or this other stuff to, you know, the legal side of it. He just did it instinctively, you know, and I think that good teachers, like you sound like, I'm sure you are, you know, you know in your class which ones need a little something else and which one needs to get directions repeated or whatever, and you kind of do it, you know, without having to label the child as disabled, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. We've been talking to Dr. Richard Selznick, author of School Struggles, A Guide to Your Shutdown Learner's Success. That's the book that I read. He also has another one, which I'm going to try to look for as well, called The Shutdown Learner. So where can people get these books and how can they find out more about you?
There's a website that I have called, you can look up in either way, theshutdownlearner.com, or it's under I shortened my name, Dr. Selz, S-E-L-Z, D-R-S-E-L-Z.com. That's Dr. Selz, not selling anything, but S-E-L-Z.com. I'm on Facebook. If you look up on Facebook under Shutdown Learner, I post a lot of things there, you know, articles of not just my own, you know, special education or, you know, all kinds of other things like that. I'm on a website called JenningsWire.com. You know, there's a blog there, JenningsWire. I'm the director of the Cooper Learning Center in Voorhees. So if they look up Cooper Learning Center, they might find me that way. Twitter under @DrSelz, D-R-S-E-L-Z. Your listeners or your readers, feel free to contact me.
Twitter's my favorite, so...
I like Twitter too, you know. I like it a lot too. I really do enjoy it, you know. And it's there's something about it. You get a lot of links and a lot of information, and you know, I find some great stuff coming out on Twitter.
Yeah, me too. And it's so much. It's my preferred method of communication. It's so much more direct and open and honest than an email. Get to the point. You know.
Yeah.
You got two sentences to do it.
Funny you say that. I find myself of the group, that's my favorite one too. And I think there are a lot of people who don't really understand its use yet. You know, they still think of it as like Ashton Kutcher stuff. You know. You know, where you're, you know, oh, I'm here in a restaurant or whatever. I never post those kind of things. I'm always posting what I think are, in, you know, hopefully interesting links, you know, things that people might find interesting within the field. I don't usually do the personal side of it.
Very cool. All right. Well, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for sending
me. Stay in touch. You know, it's been a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this conversation.